history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you. There are men and women in our midst that we really don't know what they've done for the sake of our country unless we take the time to ask them and listen to their stories. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And today, we're going to meet a young Marine. Well, he's 90 years young these days, and we're going to go back a lot further than that with Glenn Bram of Gilroy, California. And I know they say once a Marine, always a Marine, but I guess once from Gilroy, always from Gilroy for you.
Yep, that's right. I was born here.
Did they call it the garlic capital of the world then?
Yep. No, that came later.
How big a difference is there? I know there's the big garlic festival here every year, and the city has grown. Can you contrast what it was like when you were a kid compared to Gilroy now?
Oh, when I was a kid, I can remember when there was 1,500 people in Gilroy. Now there's over 50,000.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when we went to school, there was the high school was probably 100, I guess. But Gilroy's grown a lot. I don't know, my dad was on the police department here in the early 1940s, 38 and 40. And he was on there for 4 years. And him and one other cop were on at night, and they were only two that were on. When one of them took his night off, the other one was on by himself, and that was it. There wasn't much going on.
Yep, that does put it in perspective. When you only have two cops, I guess it's not that big a town, and I guess you couldn't get into any trouble if your dad was one of the two.
No.
But you grew up on the Pacheco Pass, and anyone who's come through this part of California has made that drive. A lot of times it's pretty golden and dry, but right now it's gorgeous. Man, what a beautiful drive I had over the pass today.
It is beautiful this year, yep.
With the wildflowers and rolling green hills and the little creeks and, of course, the big reservoir that wasn't there when you were growing up.
No.
What was your childhood like? Were you out chasing game in the hills and doing stuff like that?
Fishing and hunting. I was born and raised with that. We had a cattle ranch and had deer hunting. So I was hunting all the time, and right here in Gilroy, I could go out and shoot jackrabbits just where I'm living right now. Why it was just all hay fields and fishing. Why we caught steelhead in the creek. And once they put the dam in, the Uvas Dam, why it stopped that. They couldn't get up. And the steelhead do come up, but not as many. But that was something we did. I'd take my bicycle and ride out to the Uvas Creek and catch my limit of fish and come home.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the hunting. Now, I read a description of you in a book that someone wrote about Saipan where it heaped high praise on your aim and your eye as a sharpshooter. Was that honed in those youth years here in Gilroy?
Probably, because when I went in the Marines, I was only 17.
Mm-hmm.
And so on the rifle range, we shot a practice round before the day shooting for record. And the perfect score was 340, and I shot 338 that day. And so all these officers says, oh, this kid's going to break the record tomorrow. Well, a little wind came up, and it threw it off a little bit, but I still shot 326, and there were 65 in our platoon, and I won $1 from each one of them, so I won $65. And they wanted me to stay and be an instructor. But you had to be 19 years old, so I couldn't do that. So.
Uh-huh. I could see how that would develop a reputation for you. Yeah. And as I sit here looking at you, you're under a couple of bucks that you shot decades ago and a lamp next to you made out of antlers. And I guess the proof is in the pudding here.
Yeah.
Was that something that you always thought about, getting in the service someday? Or did that come about because
right
of
after
the war?
Right after the war. See, the war in December, a lot of my friends joined right away. Well, I graduated from high school in June of 42, but I was only 16 when I graduated.
Wow.
I tried to get in then, and they said, no. I went to San Francisco, and the tried to get in the Marines. They said, well, we'll call you when we think you're old enough. So they called in February of 43 and asked if I was still interested. And I said, yeah. So they said, we'll come up right away. So I went up and they said, how long do you need to settle all your affairs before you leave? And I said, I don't have anything to settle. They said, well, come up tomorrow and you're on your way. So I went up and took the physical, and then I went. So that was pretty fast.
I guess so. And I've got to ask you, I'm sorry to bounce around, and we're going to hear about all the battles you were in, Tarawa and Saipan and Tinian and Okinawa. But about December 7th, you mentioned that you wanted to sign up right afterwards, but what do you remember about that day specifically and how you got the news?
That day I was duck hunting. Uh-huh. We were coming back from Las Panas.
Hey, hey, my hometown.
And left a friend of ours off at Bell Station. He worked for the state highway, and they had the state yard there before, just past Bell Station. So we left him off, and his wife told us about it. So that's the first I knew about it. But
did your eyes get as big as saucers?
Yeah.
Did that blow your mind a little bit?
Oh, yeah. And a lot of the Japanese, I went to school with so many of them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still friends with a lot of them. I play golf with them, but they shipped them all out. No, we were sure surprised.
What was that like to see these guys that you'd gone to school with, played sports with, been friends with, and all of a sudden they're enemy aliens?
I didn't think it was right, really, because the ones that were left with me, I trusted them. I mean, I knew it wasn't their fault.
Mm-hmm.
That's why when I came home, guys says, how can you play golf with some of the guys that were shooting at you? And I said, well, they weren't the ones. So.
But there were guys shooting at you, and we're going to hear
that.
And what about the Marines attracted you? Why did you want to be one of those guys?
I don't know. I just because of shooting. Well, I didn't want to get in the Navy because I couldn't swim.
Ah.
Didn't want to get in the Air Corps because I was afraid of heights. So I thought the Marines would be the one. So.
Little did you know what you were getting into. So you told us about your marksmanship that was evident early on. Was there kind of a welcome to the Marine Corps moment for you that really kind of christened you, or a trial by fire, baptism by fire kind of moment?
When I first got in, I realized when we went into boot camp, we went in, guys that were already there for a few weeks, says, you'll be sorry. Well, I knew right away what they were talking about. After a couple of weeks, I wondered, what am I doing here? Because they gave you a lot of crap and,
uh-huh.
and made you like it. But the boot camp training was fast. At that time, I forget, it was only a couple of months, I guess. We moved through pretty fast.
Yeah. Well, they had to get you over there for those battles. You told me you had a brother. Did he end up in the war also?
Later on, he went in the Air Corps, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you're in the Marine Corps. You do all this training. And at what point did you start to get familiar with the BAR, the Browning Automatic Rifle? Because I read that was one of your duties.
Yeah, well, after I got overseas, but I shot it in boot camp. We had the M1, the Garand, we shot that, and then we shot the BAR. But I liked the BAR. It was good. And once I got over there, I got a hold of it. They gave me one. Even afterwards, when I became a squad leader later, I just had a carbine.
Mm-hmm.
But if there was a chance to pick up a BAR, I did it. I mean, you could always find one because I liked them.
And what about this nickname? Who started calling you Pluto? Where in the world did that come from?
One of the guys in my outfit said, they showed movies sometimes. And after the war, the campaign was over, they brought in movies. And they said I laughed like Pluto, the way I laughed. So somebody said that, and then they just gave me that. In fact, there was, at the same time, they'd congratulate somebody on their birthday or something at the movie. And this one night, the guy says, oh, I want to congratulate Pluto Brem. He's the proud father of twins. Pluto's been over here for 18 months. And all these officers laughed. Well, here, I've been over there 18 months, and the proud father of twins.
Right. So, how do you pull that off?
Yeah.
that's a long gestation period, isn't it? And I'm sure your wife Muriel would be very interested
to hear about
that. Speaking of, did you meet her before you went overseas?
We went to high school together, yeah.
Uh-huh. So before you went overseas, did you have any inkling that this one might be your wife someday?
No. We went out a couple of times, but that was about it. But
uh-huh.
We wrote a couple of letters, and then when I got home on the furlough, I was home 2 or 3 weeks and finally ran into her, and we dated a couple of times. Then I went back to duty and then came home on another furlough for 30 days. Finally, I got discharged in October. We had gone together probably from June to October, and when I got discharged, we decided we'd get married, so we got married in December. Mm-hmm. Both young. I was 20 and she was 19.
But I guess it worked.
Yeah.
70 years later, you can talk about you had 5 children together, you have 15 grandkids, 32 great-grandkids. I guess it worked out all right. Yeah. I guess it's really good that you made it home from the war, and we're going to hear how many odds you beat to do that. Tell me about this first one, and a lot of people don't know about this battle. If they were alive then, they did, because it turned into a documentary film that actually won an Oscar with the Marines at Tarawa. Tarawa, as some might say.
Yeah, we called it Tarawa, yeah.
You can hear it 10 different ways, but you were there and you know how bloody it was. Yeah. How did you experience that battle over a tiny little strip of land?
Well, it was tough. The landing, there was, when you got on the beach, we had about a 1 foot foothold on there because you couldn't, there was, we were right up against a little barrier and you couldn't stick your head up because they'd peck at you. And the waves that came in later were getting more punishment than we took. And some of them got dumped into 10 or 15 feet of water, too. The boats didn't come in far enough.
Yeah.
The second day was worse, but finally we got them straightened out a little bit where they could get in. But in fact, I think they said that after the first day, they didn't think they were going to send any more in. There was no use, but they did. But it took 4 days, and the island was only a couple of miles long and, I don't know, 3/4 of a mile wide at the widest spot.
Mm-hmm.
But it was fast, and they had pillboxes that were, I don't know, 6 or 7 stories deep. And that's why they bombed them for weeks and thought they had everything cleaned out. But they were just like squirrels that go down, and after the shelling was over, they'd come back up again.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just imagining you and how ill-prepared you must have been as a teenager who's never been in combat
before,
what you're up against.
Yeah.
How did you handle that? Were you scared? I mean, did you think you were going to survive it?
Well, you just wonder when you were going to get hit, I guess. But, I mean, sure, you were scared, and you prayed a little bit. Like they said, that there's no atheist in the foxhole. But anyway, when you're young, the older you get, the more you really think about it.
Mm-hmm.
But then after we were only on there 4 days, and then that was over, then we came home and went to Hawaii then.
Well, you probably needed to recover from what you endured there and what you saw. And you said, you know, you're waiting to get hit. Well, while you're waiting, you're seeing other guys get hit.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What was that like? And I'm sure some of these guys are guys, if you didn't know them, you'd been around them, you'd seen them.
Yeah.
What was that like? And can you give us a sense of what you witnessed there and how hard it was?
I don't know how to explain it. I mean, you see something like that, and you can't believe it, really, when you see a guy get blown up, some of them getting hit in the head. It's tough to even think about.
Did you have any contact with your family during this time?
No.
No letters or nothing?
No. Later on, I'd get a letter about every few months, but no, I didn't talk to my family. Well, it was 30 months before I even came home.
Yeah. So you survive Tarawa,
yeah,
and you get to Hawaii.
We were in Hilo for about 6 months. That was just recuperating and then started training for the next operation.
During that time, as you left Tarawa and maybe during your time in Hawaii, was there a point at which you grasped the magnitude of that battle that you had been in, or the magnitude of the losses there by your division?
Yeah, you're just wondering if you were lucky, figured you were lucky to get through it, and wondered what was coming next. You knew there was going to be another one.
Yeah.
Then you wondered if you're going to get through that one. So, you know, each one, the law of averages kind of gets to you.
And Glenn spent a lot of time defying those odds until becoming a Purple Heart recipient himself. We're going to hear about that before we're done. And we also have a video up on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page with Glenn showing you where he got hit. So much of the story is where he didn't get hit and why a jammed rifle may have saved his life. As for Tarawa, in November of 1943, that 4-day battle over 1 square mile of hell, as an acclaimed book put it, claimed over 6,000 lives if you add up both sides. More than 1,000 American Marines were killed, more than 2,000 more wounded, and nearly 700 sailors were killed when the Japanese sank the escort carrier USS Liscombe Bay. One of our upcoming episodes will feature a man who witnessed that sinking, but when we come back with 90-year-old Glenn Brehm, we'll follow him to Saipan, Tinian, and eventually Okinawa. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right, consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with 90-year-old Glenn Brehm of Gilroy, California. He was just 17 when he enlisted in the Marine Corps in 1942. You'll find photos of what he looked like then and, of course, now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. If you ever find yourself in Gilroy, the garlic capital of the world, you might want to check out the ruins of the Henry Miller Mansion on Mount Madonna. Henry Miller was a German immigrant who landed in San Francisco in 1850 with just $6 in his pocket, but became the most prolific cattle rancher in the country. Glenn Bram's grandmother was first cousin to the Cattle King of California, and that's how his family ended up in this country. Henry Miller paved the way, and relatives like Glenn's grandmother followed. So we have Henry Miller to thank for this courageous Marine who survived the Battle of Tarawa with the 2nd Marine Division in November of 1943, and by June of 44 was headed to another major Pacific battle, one detailed in James Campbell's book, The Color of War, which includes a few mentions of a young Marine named Glenn Pluto Bram.
And the next one was Saipan.
Saipan.
And I've talked to quite a few guys who were there, and I've heard some gruesome stories from that. But I understand, if I'm reading this correctly, a book that features a little bit of your story, sounds like one of your first stories on Saipan wasn't necessarily a deadly one or a scary one, but a really smelly one. Did you really make a foxhole in a septic tank your first night over there?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
How'd you pull that off?
Well, I don't know. It was easy digging, but when it when it seeped in at night, well, there was nothing. You were stuck in there. You had to stay there. So.
And then you were probably stuck with that smell for quite a while.
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely. It would. Not only that smell, you had all kinds of smells that you couldn't get rid of. You didn't even change your socks for a couple of weeks sometimes.
Yeah. Did you catch a little ribbing over that, the septic tank?
Yeah, a little bit. They stayed away from me for a while.
What was that like, and how was it different from what you'd experienced on Tarawa?
Well, there was more artillery fire from on Saipan. They had these rockets coming in. You could hear them coming, going, shoo, 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 shoo. And then they'd hit. And the minute they'd hit, why, you could move a little bit. And we always tried to go to where one already hit. You felt you were safer there. Mm. And the first night we were on there, they told us to pull back with the heavy shelling. So we headed back for the beach, and you had to wait when these barrages were over. In between, you'd to run a little bit, and then dig down again and then run some more. But guys were getting picked off all around. I just wondered if you were going to be next. But
well, and I have to imagine there were a few moments where that came pretty close to happening.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was quite a few times. One time I was laying on my stomach on Saipan, and the bullet hit right under my eye, and it put dirt in there, and I couldn't see out of that eye at all. And
so it hit the dirt right under your eye, and splashed dirt right up on you. Matter of inches.
Yeah. And then another time, one grazed my wrist, and I was laying there. Another time on my BAR, I had my head down like that, and the bullet hit the operating handle and blew that off. And that was a loud concussion.
Yeah.
But those are the ones that you don't know how many go by that you don't know were close. I mean,
yeah.
If you hear it, it's already gone.
What kinds of assignments did you guys have there? Can you give us a taste of the day-to-day, what your experience might have been like?
Well, for some reason, I took out quite a few patrols. They'd say, well, Pluto, take three guys and go 300 yards ahead here and see what you can find. So you never knew what you're going to run into. Then another time, our platoon was kind of cut off, and we didn't know where the rest of the outfit was. And so the captain says, Pluto, take some volunteers and go back and see if you can find the rest of the outfit. So I just took my whole squad. They all wanted to go with me, so we went back, and we didn't know where we were going. And we just started out, and just down below us, about 100 yards, there was a Japanese guy in there going through some food, rattling cans, and the guys wanted to shoot him. And I said, no, if we shoot, we're going to give away our position. Let's let him go for now. So we went, and we had to go back. We went back about 400 or 500 yards and finally saw a guy sitting on a hill, and he waved at us, and that was our outfit. So we went up, and he says, as we got there, just ahead of us, there were three Japs right ahead of us that turned to the right, and we turned to the left where he was. And he says they couldn't have been 50 yards ahead of us. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we got up there, and then they said to send somebody back to get our outfit. So I sent two guys back to bring them, so the whole platoon came back then. So they were happy to get out of there.
I suppose so.
Yeah.
How are your food supplies there on Saipan? Did you have lots of hot, comfy meals to enjoy on a nightly basis?
K-rations and C-rations. There wasn't much hot food at all.
Did you get used to that?
Yeah.
Didn't have much of a choice?
That was it. You got spaghetti and meatballs we got in cans and once in a while, and powdered eggs and the K-rations. But you got used to it.
Did the indefinite nature of it ever get to you? In other words, day after day after day of this kind of combat, being on edge, knowing the enemy's after you and not knowing when it's all going to end, did that ever weigh on you?
Well, I guess it did, but you didn't pay that much attention to it. You knew you were stuck there anyway, so it's no use worrying about it. Yeah, I can't remember how I felt, really.
But you were there till the end of that one, until the island was secure?
Yeah, well, then we went, they took some of us with some replacements to go over to Tinian, which was pretty close. So we went over, we landed on there then, and that wasn't too bad. We were there a few days, and then came back to Saipan again. And finally, we left there, and then we went to Guadalcanal for a rest camp, which was a good place to go, Guadalcanal. So we were there for 6 months, and then preparing for Okinawa.
I want to ask you a little more about Saipan in light of a couple things that veterans have shared about that battle. One, I've talked to some guys who were involved in situations, and there was one very famous one at the end of that battle of bonsai charges by the enemy.
Yeah.
Did you experience firsthand or witness anything
like
that?
Oh, yeah. And there was one time they were charged uphill, and they were throwing grenades up at us, and they were rolling back on themselves. I mean, wasn't much there. You're just picking them off. I mean, but they'd scream and come running up there, throwing grenades.
How did you feel about the enemy? I know that sounds like a goofy question, but
well, to me at that time, I knew they were going to be shooting at me. It didn't bother me at all shooting at any of them. Some of the replacements that came in, they'd see a couple guys in a foxhole and holler, "Barman, Barman," and call me over to shoot them. They wouldn't do it. And So I remember there was one time, I don't know, there's probably a dozen of them through this one little valley we went through there. And every one of them would just holler, "Barman, Barman, here's a couple here." But you get used to it, and it didn't bother me. There was one time it did. The only one that really bothered me, one of them put his hands up like he was praying. But I didn't have time to think. They says, "Don't take any prisoners coming through there." So
yeah,
I shot him too. So that bothered me.
I could see that.
Yeah.
But there are plenty of stories of guys who would fake surrender.
Oh, yeah.
Or come into your camps at night, or pretend to be American,
right,
or all kinds of things.
Yeah.
Were you able to sleep at night?
Yeah, pretty well. But, I mean, you don't get a long sleep. You sleep a few minutes, and usually there were two of you in a hole where one could sleep a little bit and then the other one stay awake.
And you mentioned the in that bonsai charge, the Japanese throwing grenades uphill and they'd roll back down on them. From what I read in that book, there was an incident where you almost got blown up by one of your...
A buddy of mine, yeah.
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 Tell me what happened there.
Well, they sent us to, if I remember right, to get some grenades or something. And when we came back, the sniper picked at us. So we got behind a rock. It was a little shack. So I told this, Frank Border was the guy with me. I says, go around the back and see if you can throw a grenade in there. And if he comes out the front, I'll get him. So he went around the back and he threw a grenade, but he threw it over the top of the shack and it blew up. I ducked behind a rock. It blew up right in front of me. So then anyway, I went in and shot him. Wasn't too much trouble there. So that took care of that one.
Yeah, I could see how that one would get your attention too. And the other thing on Saipan that has been, you know, well publicized over the years, that's just one of the great tragedies of the war, is the misinformation, the propaganda that the Japanese were sharing with the inhabitants of the island. And saying things that caused women and children to jump off
that
suicide cliff.
We saw that many times, jumping off the suicide cliffs. They'd just throw their kids off and then jump after them.
That had to sicken you.
Oh, boy, that was bad.
Well, I guess when you see an enemy that is doing things like that and making those kind of choices, maybe it strengthens your will or your resolve a little bit to finish this?
Yeah. In fact, one of those had some of the civilians in a little camp, and this one girl wanted some food, I guess, so I gave her a thing of K-rations. She gave me two rings. They were just made out of aluminum or stainless steel. Mm-hmm. One of them had a shape of a diamond on it. I guess they were her wedding rings. So I remember I brought those home. I don't know whatever happened to them. I had them for years.
Wow. Told you how much that food meant to her.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Well, and it also underscores how much freedom meant to everybody at that time. Yeah. And I know you were just a teenager, and you're out there, and you don't have a ton of time to think about this and that. But we're so far removed from it now, 70 years later. And I don't know if people today really have a firm grasp for what America was like then, or what it meant to fight for your country, or what you were fighting for. Can you help us maybe understand what was motivating you and the guys you were fighting with?
Well, I guess just having declared war on us, what they did on Pearl Harbor, everything. That's what, and then I had time to go to a couple of movies right after that. They came out fast. Wake Island and Back to Bataan and some of those movies, and that gets you going more. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't wait to get in.
And then you were seeing the real deal, which is a lot different from a movie.
Yeah.
So you get on from Saipan and Tinian. That's three battles now that you've survived. Mm-hmm. And I bet you were probably pretty surprised by that, given how many guys around you did not do that, or at least got sent home.
That's right.
Did you have a lot of personal friends who were wounded or killed?
Not really, because you're not with guys that long. I mean, after each campaign, where there's only a few of you left, then they bring in replacements. Mm-hmm. And then you start off again with a new bunch. But no, there was none of them that I was in there. Like in the Navy or the Air Corps, they're in there together for months and months.
Right.
But we weren't.
But the nickname stuck with you.
Yeah, that did.
Okay, Okinawa. Did you have a sense before that battle that the war was winding down, that you guys were close?
No, I don't think so. Well, we knew we were getting closer to Japan, but we thought we were going to have to go into Japan to finish it off. Mm-hmm. Remember, we landed there on Easter Sunday, April Fool's Day. It was, April the 1st. Yeah, I was on the... I was on there a month and a half before I finally got hit. I think I got hit May the 14th.
Wow. That is a long time. So what were you doing for that month and a half?
Gone, moving up in battles. One day you'd run into trouble, then you'd go 3 or 4 days and nothing would happen. Then you'd move up a little further and run into some more opposition.
What was the hardest thing for you to deal with, or maybe the most terrifying part of the whole experience for you?
Well, it was all terrifying. Remember, they wanted, just 3 days before I got shot, they wanted to send me home to go to officer's candidate school. They said they'd ship me out right now. And I says, no, after this was over, I'd be coming home anyway, because after 4 campaigns, they automatically sent you home. And then, so 3 days later, then I got shot.
And this is quite a story. And you know, I made reference to it earlier. You know, you come back and you marry Muriel and you would have 5 children. Now there's 15 grandkids and 32 great-grandkids. And this always amazes me. None of those people would be here if your rifle hadn't jammed. That's crazy.
That's what my kids keep telling me.
Yeah, well, because they're pretty thankful to be alive.
Yeah.
And we need to hear that whole story, but it's time for another break. Head to hometownheroesradio.com for photos and video of Glenn Brehm. Once a Marine, always a Marine, right? He is going strong at 90, but we're going to understand just how close he came to paying the ultimate price as a 19-year-old on Okinawa when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's visit with 90-year-old Glenn Brehm of Gilroy, California. That's where he was born, and that's where he lives today with his wife of 70 years, Muriel. They were blessed with 5 children and now can count 15 grandkids and 32 great-grandkids. None of those descendants would have ever been born if the timing had been a little different for a teenage Marine on May 14th, 1945, during the Battle of Okinawa. Tell me what happened. Your rifle jammed?
Yeah.
Where was the situation? Where were you and what was going on?
They had sent 2 squads of us in. There was some of the guys, another outfit, were trapped in this little valley. And they sent us in, and we could see them getting picked off down there. So I said, boy, I won't take my squad down. It was just then they says, Pluto, get ready, you're going down there. So you have to do it. So they sent a tank in with us. So we were behind the tank going up this little valley, and a mortar shell came in and hit right on the turret of the tank and put that out of commission. So I was right behind it. And when my rifle jammed, I bent over to fix it, and just then it felt like somebody hit me with their fist in the shoulder. And I lay in blood blowing all over, so I knew what happened. So about that time, everybody was getting hit. In fact, the other squad leader got hit with the same bullet that I got hit with. When it exploded, a chunk of it broke his arm.
Wow.
And right after that, we had this one platoon sergeant that was with us. He sent me a picture of himself after he got home. He got hit right through the mouth. It looked like a dimple on each side. It didn't hit a tooth or his tongue or anything.
Wow, what are the odds of that?
And that all happened just within a few minutes. And finally they sent smoke shells in and told us to go back. So you couldn't see anything from here to you always getting out of that smoke. So we headed back, and I jumped in a shell hole, because I got grazed in the arm, but just out of the smoke, a bullet hit me in the arm, and it hit my cartridge belt. And then I dove in the shell hole, and I dove in on my right side because this one was hurt, and I broke 2 ribs. Which I didn't know till afterwards, but I broke 2 ribs, and there were 2 guys in the hole, and they were 2 of the ones that we had gone in to try to get out, and they poured sulfa in my shoulder and everything and helped me get up to the top of the ridge, and then they took me back to the medical center then. But by that time, I had lost a lot of blood. I don't know how many pints of blood they gave me.
Yeah.
But I was still able to walk.
Well, I want to hear more about that, but I want to underscore for people, because they might be saying, well, wait a second. You said if his rifle hadn't jammed, he wouldn't be here. Well, the implication is if you're not bending over to fix that rifle, you're standing up and the shell hits you where?
It would right in the back or the shoulder. I mean,
it would have just blown you in half.
Oh, yeah. Because I still get pieces that work out, like little pimples coming. I've got, I don't know how many pieces still in my neck.
Really?
Yeah.
70 years later.
Yeah.
Wow. But it would have killed you. There's no question.
Oh, yeah,
you
wouldn't
absolutely be here.
Oh, that's right.
So it's a good thing that rifle jammed. But then, so now your shoulder's blown to bits. You dive in the hole. You crack 2 ribs. You can still walk, but you've lost all this blood. I mean, you've got to be just out of your mind. I can't imagine what was going on.
Yeah. Well, I was just happy to get back to the aid station anyway, and then they worked on me. I can remember the doctor asking me if I wanted to save some of those pieces coming out. I could hear him as he was dropping them in a can. I said, no, I don't want them. I did say, is this going to be enough to get me home? He says, it will. Don't worry about it.
Wow. How long of a process was that for you to recover?
Well, I was... I got hit May the 14th. I got home June the 14th. I'd been in the hospital in Guam for a week, and then in Pearl Harbor for another couple of weeks. And then I was in the hospital at Pleasanton for a couple of weeks afterwards. But after that, I was able to take care of it myself. But it was such a hole, they couldn't stitch it. They had to use clamps to clamp it together because the stitches kept popping. So it left a pretty good hole.
And I imagine your parents found out when you got hit. They probably got a telegram or something?
They didn't. I wrote and told them that I'd gotten hit and I was coming home, so don't worry about me. They didn't. I was home on a furlough when they got the information that I had gotten hit.
You mean you saw them before they knew that you were wounded?
Well, I told them I was wounded, but...
Okay, so you told them in person before letter actually arrived.
On a letter, I told them that I was wounded.
Yeah.
I did that when I was in Pearl Harbor.
Oh, I get it. Okay. This might be a tough one to answer because I get the sense that there's not a lot that slows you down. If you're 90 years old and you're still golfing, and I can see how much of your life you've spent hunting, I don't think too many things since World War II have slowed you down. But there's got to be some kind of lasting impact of an injury that severe that basically blows off the top of your left shoulder.
Well, I can't raise my arm too high. I mean, when I got discharged, they said, do you want to stay around for a medical discharge? And I said, how long will that take? Well, they don't know. I said, if I can get out now, I'll take it. I'll go now. So they did. They gave me a 20% disability. And I got that for about 2 years, and they called me up and said for another examination to see what it was, and they found out that I should have been getting 40% disability. So they gave me that. It was retroactive, which didn't amount to too much, but it was still quite a bit. So I've been getting that ever since. But I think if I would have stuck around for a medical discharge, I probably could have gotten 50%.
And as far as the way it is today, or for all these years, have you had pain or it's just kind of limited mobility?
Just limited, but it bothers my golf swing. I don't have any backswing at all. They tied the tendons too tight, so that's why I can't raise my arm too high. But it doesn't bother me that bad.
So you were already home when Japan surrendered?
Yeah, I was home on a furlough.
What was that like for you after every, I mean, you've been at some pretty significant battles against these guys.
Well, I remember my cousin and I went deer hunting. As soon as it was over, we took off, went up to the ranch deer hunting for the weekend. Everybody was celebrating in town, and we went off by ourselves deer hunting.
How much have you told your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids about this over the years?
Very little. I mean, once in a while they'll ask me questions, and I'll tell them something, but I just never cared to even talk about it, really.
You were glad to get home and didn't need to live in the past.
That's right, yeah.
And I know you can't squeeze 70 years into a couple minutes, but what have you been up to since the war ended?
Well, just having kids.
That was Muriel's job.
No, I worked for the Gilroy Lumber Company about 25 years. I retired when I was 55. I had a stroke. Some friends and I were fishing in Idaho, and I had a stroke there. I was in intensive care for a few days, and finally my wife and one of my sons came up, and a son-in-law took a motor home and picked me up and brought me home. But they wondered what caused the stroke. They gave me all kinds of tests when I got home. Just about 2 weeks before I left to go fishing, the doctor cut a piece of shrapnel out of my neck. And when he was cutting, I could feel it clicking in there on my windpipe. I says, that clicking my wind? No, he says, don't worry about it. He says, there's a lot of things more important than that. He says, it's right on the carotid artery. And I think that's what happened when a chunk of something got in that carotid artery afterwards.
Sure,
what caused it.
And you still have pieces of that shrapnel in there.
Yeah.
About how often does one of them work its way to the surface?
Oh, every 6 or 8 months a piece will come out. In fact, my wife pulled one out some years ago. It was just like a little fish hook. And she pulled it out, and it had about an inch piece of my jacket still hanging on the piece of shrapnel.
Your jacket had been under your skin for all those years?
Yeah.
Wow. That's crazy. Yeah. When you think back on that time, and obviously this is a lot of nights spent in foxholes, a lot of days in combat, a lot of close calls, that closest call we just heard about. But what are the things that today maybe you still think about and say, you know, somebody was really looking out for me there, or I'm really proud of how I handled that there?
Well, it's a sense somebody was looking out for me, that's for sure. As far as handling things, the one thing that started me off right when I first went overseas, we went to Wellington, New Zealand, for replacements for the 2nd Division after Guadalcanal. So some of the guys that were on Guadalcanal were with us. We were getting ready to go to Tarawa. And this one sergeant told me, he says, when you land, make sure you don't go out. When they drop the ramp down, don't go out, go over the side of the boat. He says, if they have a machine gun trained on that ramp, it'll get everybody. So he says, go over the side. Mm. Well, I did. I didn't know how deep the water was, and I couldn't swim. But anyway, it was only up over my chest a little bit. But I remember that's something that probably helped me, just what he told me there.
Sure. You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because that was the question I was going to ask you that I forgot, with not being able to swim.
Yeah.
Was there ever a point during your time in the service where you thought that was going to be your undoing, where you found yourself in a situation?
I thought that might have been, but I was lucky enough. We were in close enough. In fact, I came in under a pier right afterwards. There was a little pier there, and I came in under that. But those, some of the ones behind me, they just drowned right there.
Mm-hmm. What are you most proud of with regard to your time in the Marine Corps?
I'm just proud to be a Marine, I guess, that's for sure. I mean, it was a good outfit.
Do you have some pride based on what collectively 16 million Americans in the armed forces and all the people back at home supporting them, what you were able to accomplish?
What bothers me are the ones that came back from Vietnam and Korea with the treatment they got. I didn't think that was right. I mean, we didn't get treated that way when we got home. We got treated as heroes, which the heroes are the dead ones, really.
And there were a lot of those at those battles that you were in and throughout the war, 406,000 of them.
Yeah.
And that makes me wonder if you have been to the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., to see that wall of gold stars that represents 406,000.
I haven't seen that. We were there before.
When you think of that number, that more than 400,000 Americans died, and you know how close you came to adding to that, what does that mean to you? What do you think of when you consider that?
Well, when you think about the Civil War, it's nothing. Look what they did.
That's true.
But if we hadn't have, a lot of people thought the atomic bomb was terrible. It was bad, but we would have lost a lot more if we would have had to go into Japan.
Mm-hmm.
That saved a lot of lives on both sides.
Was it hard for you? I mean, I'm thinking again of your age. You told us, you know, you were 20 and Muriel was 19 when you got married. Did it take a while for you to get used to being a civilian again, and you're not out there living with all these grungy Marines who haven't had a shower in a month?
No, it didn't. I got over that pretty fast.
And I guess that's the other thing I have to ask you. If you've been married for 70 years, you must have some great sage advice for us, because, you know, a lot of us aspire to be able to say that someday. What's your secret?
There's a little sign right above you there.
Never miss a good chance to shut up?
Yep. That's it. Whenever something's starting, I just look at that. And it's
Do you have any more of those? Can I take one home with me? Well, Glenn, I just want to say thank you for serving our country and for telling us a little bit. Is there anything that I didn't ask you about that you think people should know?
Can't think of anything, really. You did pretty good. Like I say, I remember more about the poker games and crap games, and blackjack games.
You were pretty good at those?
Yeah, I did pretty good. In fact, just before I got discharged, I was up at Mare Island. I put in a call to Muriel. There was a crap game. At that time, the phones weren't very fast. You had to wait a half an hour before your call could get through. So there was a crap game going on right by the telephone. So I got in there. By the time the phone rang, I had $300 and a wristwatch. So that's, I used that $300 to buy her a ring.
There you go. Those crap games paid off.
Yeah.
And with that, we're out of time for today's show. Don't forget to pull up that short video of Glenn on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.